Welcome back to the Narrative Monopoly Podcast. On today's episode, we have former Wall Street Journal editor-in-chief Gerard Baker. I was really excited about this one because I started subscribing to the Wall Street Journal probably about 10 years ago when he was the editor-in-chief, and he is someone who I've always looked to as an honest voice in the media, and we will get to all that in the interview. I think it'll become glaringly obvious why I think that in the interview. He's also the host of Wall Street Journal at Large on the Fox Business Channel, and this is the longest episode to date, so without further ado, let's press play. Gerard Baker, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So I'm really excited to speak with you today. As you know, the narrative monopoly has a lot to do with narratives that are distributed through the media. So I'm excited to dive in deep to that. You spent time as editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. I was a happy subscriber when you were there. And I want to start off today with asking you, how did you get into journalism?
Well, actually, thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. It was actually somewhat by accident, really. I hadn't really intended to be a journalist when I was growing up. I was always almost obsessively, addictively interested in news and history and politics. One of my earliest memories is sitting up as a very, very young child watching. I grew up in Britain, as you can tell from my accent. I've lived in the States for 25 years, but I grew up in Britain. One of my very earliest recollections was being up late at night watching the returns as a child, literally the returns in the 1970 general election in Britain. I was kind of a nerdy politics, history kind of person. So I was fascinated, but didn't really think about journalism at all. I studied philosophy, politics, and economics at university, and was fascinated by all those topics, and remain fascinated by them. And then I actually went into finance to start with. I actually worked in the City of London. I'd done quite a bit of economics, and I enjoyed working. I worked in the City of London initially for the Bank of England, the UK Central Bank, and then for a private bank. I didn't find it rewarding. And I applied for a job I'd not done any journalism at college or anything like that. But I applied for a job with a British television company, which has since disappeared, but it's been subsumed by another company called London Weekend Television. And they had a very famous nationally broadcast news and current affairs program called Weekend World. And they wanted someone with some background in economics. I applied. To my surprise, I got the job as it was a researcher. They had a very good training program there. They trained me in both basic journalism and then in television. I did that for a couple of years. Then I got hired by the BBC to do something very similar. BBC had, again, more training and a very extensive training program, again, both more journalism training and specifically television training. So I went there, and then I went through various jobs at the BBC. I really wanted to write. I mean, my passion was write. I'd always enjoyed writing at college, and the thing I most enjoyed about the television was the writing part of the television rather than the shooting and appearing on TV. And I got offered a job with a newspaper, the Financial Times. Someone there knew what my work at the BBC knew. I'd done a lot of economics reporting at the BBC, and they liked that. They hired me to the Financial Times. So it was a very strange roundabout way. And I hadn't done journalism at college. I went into finance, first of all, as an economist. Then I got hired in television initially, and then I went print. So it's almost kind of like most people start off in print and then go into television. I went sort of the other way around. But that was, again, it came from a passion to understand news and what was going on in the world, to report on it, to find out what was happening and to explain it. So that's how it came about.
And when you made the transition from journalist to editor, was there any friction there? What do you see as the biggest difference between being the editor and the actual journalist on the ground?
It's a big difference. I mean, there are a number of famous management axioms and management theories, about what happens to people as they rise through an organization. The Peter principle is one of them, you know, as you probably know, which is that, you know, everybody rises to their level of incompetence. I'm not suggesting that was true in my case, although probably it's true in everybody's case. So, and it applies, you know, in any organization, it applies, you know, you get good at doing one thing, you're good, you get a reputation for doing that, you do that very, very well, and you get sort of promoted to a higher level, which often involves lots and lots of things that you haven't been doing before. That's particularly true in journalism, I think. I mean, I spent about 10 years in television. And then I spent 10 years as a writer, really, in print newspaper, mostly at the Financial Times, writing as a reporter at the Financial Times, initially in Tokyo in Japan for a few years, writing on the financial system in Tokyo, reporting on that. Then going to Washington, I covered the Federal Reserve for a long time, reporting on the Federal Reserve and doing all of them, you know, doing all those things that you need to do as a reporter, finding out what's going on, developing sources, you know, working on stories, writing stories, developing a record of coverage and expertise in an area, a beat that that comes through those skills that are required for reporting. And you become an editor. I became Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times initially, which is running a big bureau by the standards of that paper. There were about 12 of us in the bureau, and I ran that bureau for a few years. And there, I was still doing a bit of writing. But there you're editing more, you're assigning, you're managing 10, 12 people, whatever it was, you're managing their careers, you're, again, assigning them stories, you're guiding them in stories, you're mentoring them to some extent, you're hiring, doing a lot of hiring, the occasional firing, you know, and so you're doing, a whole different set of skills. And then I moved to the Journal, initially as deputy editor. Again, I wasn't doing any writing, any reporting. I did still do a bit of reporting because you get involved in stories and you help out with stories and you report. But obviously, my main job as deputy editor was basically to edit, which means now as deputy, I wasn't running the place. So I wasn't primarily responsible for hiring and management issues, but I was very much involved in story editing and signing and talking to reporters and other editors. It's a very different set of skills. And then, of course, ultimately, I became editor in chief. Where you are responsible for all of those managerial as well as those editorial responsibilities. So it is, yeah, it's, look, the same fundamental qualities are what's needed, whether you're a reporter or an editor, which is good news judgment, an inquisitiveness, a skepticism, I think is a good thing. And we can talk a little bit more about that because I think, unfortunately, there probably isn't enough skepticism these days in a lot of reporting. I think that's one of the things that's led to so many problems. You know, skepticism, curiosity, a critical capacity, an understanding of what good writing is, whether you're writing it or you're editing it. And above all else, I think, and perhaps more as an editor than as a, this is how I saw myself all the time as editor in chief, I put myself in the place of the reader. I mean, what I think the biggest, possibly the biggest difference of all between reporting and editing is that as a reporter, you're trying to find out, you're finding out the story, you're finding out what to write about, you're trying to find the right people to talk to find out what happened and then to explain what happened and to report the story in that way. From the editor's, but I really put myself in the position of the reader. What would be in the reader's mind as they come to that story? What do they really want to know? Some of this stuff is extraneous. They don't really want to know that. They want to know, you know, I've heard from this person in the story, but what about someone else? So what about hearing from somebody else? So again, I think that, you know, that, if not the biggest difference, that is one of the biggest differences, and it's a skill you have to learn and have to develop. But yeah, they are quite, as in any organization, as I say, the differences between being kind of on the shop floor, as it were, as someone who's producing the material, the content, whatever it is, and someone who's responsible for managing a team who's producing that, they are quite different. They are quite obviously quite different roles.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, you know, the one piece for me is story selection. When you're talking about signing stories and you're talking about news judgment, everything you just touched on, you know, maybe the answer here is skepticism. What I'd like your insight on is there seems to be a lack of transparency in story selection, in sourcing selection, in the news judgment you just talked about, where I think, you know, with the internet, the whole world has become incredibly transparent, but this is still a bit of a black box. And I'm curious, on the day-to-day basis, you know, what does that look like when you're in a newsroom? Obviously, you have all of the wire services, you have TV, you have people you have on the ground, and you're getting all of this information. You know, what goes into the judgment of, all right, we're going to run with this?
So I think you're absolutely right. I think story selection is critical. It's critical both in terms of what I was just talking about, in terms of what the putting yourself in the reader's position. What does the reader or the viewer, whoever they are, if it's TV or listener, if it's, you know, radio, podcasts, whatever, what do they want to hear? And that applies not only to what's in the story, but most importantly, what stories do they want to hear? And again, we'll come on, I'm sure, and talk about media bias and the way in which the media presents a particular, many of them, unfortunately, much of the media presents a particular view of the world. And, you know, you've written a lot about the narrative, and that's very much key to the media's accounting of the narrative is story selection. And that's where most of the issues of bias, frankly, occur. And conscious bias, unconscious bias, and much of it is unconscious, actually. But the story selection process is absolutely critical, because there are, I mean, Wall Street Journal, we're a big news organization, we have 1,300, 1,400 journalistic staff, reporters, editors. So we're big. But even as big as we are, or as big as some of those other news organizations, I can't cover everything. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of the infinite number of things pretty almost happening every day that could be of interest, that could tell us something important, that need attention, that need scrutiny in the world. Which ones do you choose? And I think you're right in terms of the transparency. I mean, I don't know that, I don't know that internet, you know, the people who are producing, you know, relative, let's say what we used to call sort of new media, all these, you know, digital operations, from, you know, ones that became quite big like BuzzFeed or Huffington Post or whatever, down to, you know, frankly, the guy, sitting at home at his computer, you know, making phone calls and doing his own thing. You know, blogs used to be a big thing, that they've gone away. But so that, I don't know that those are necessarily any more transparent than media, than traditional media organizations. They still, I mean, sometimes they are. Some of them say, look, I'm choosing this story because I think because of this or whatever. But I think the problem is, the problem that particularly as it applies to the big news organizations, is that it's true that there's no transparency about those, but it's also they are so dominant. They have the ability in their story selection still to this day. And, you know, the impact, the influence of those traditional media companies, whether it's the Journal, the New York Times in this country, the Washington Post, CNN, CBS, ABC, there's a handful, right? They're much less important and much less powerful than they were 30, 40 years ago, but they still drive the conversation to a considerable extent. New York, you know, especially, you know, again, we, the Journal, probably do it especially more on the business side. If the journal puts on its front page, or as we used to say, or makes a big deal, you know, promotes heavily a story that we've done, on some financial institution, that tends to drive coverage of that financial institution. The Times and the Washington Post still drive a lot of the political coverage. And that is, again, that's where the power still comes. And again, it has been significantly diluted with the growth of digital news organizations, with the democratization, if you like, of the internet, and with things like, you know, Twitter and Facebook, social media. Obviously, the fact that somebody can, you know, can somebody, if you pick the right story, if you find the right story, you can have, you know, obviously we can talk about the current circumstances that's going on with social media and the efforts to kind of exclude certain voices from social media. But you can, you know, you can, and there have been examples of someone who finds something out, puts it on Twitter, and can be as influential for a day, for a week, as the New York Times can be. But again, that's still the tremendous sort of monolithic power of organizations like the New York Times, or, you know, CNN to some extent, or the Journal, still drives so much of the political, current affairs, cultural conversation of this country. And there, the issue of story selection. That's why the issue of story selection is so important. The New York Times, again, you know, I think the New York Times, frankly, these days has become a paper primarily for people of a particular ideological view. I, again, when I first came to the States 30 years ago, conservatives read the New York Times. They never liked it, frankly. I mean, we always saw the bias, but you know, it was an important newspaper and it would do important stories, and it would do, and it did, of course, you know, famously in the 1990s, you know, some big, you know, stories that were very damaging to Bill Clinton and to the Democratic Party. It was an important, you know, there was always an ideological bent, but it didn't stop it from doing stories that actually, you know, if you like, kind of hurt the ideological agenda because they were journalists first. That's gone, I think. Now, I think it's just so hard to imagine the New York Times, partly because of its readership and subscribership, is so expectant of a particular ideological bent, it's hard for them to do it. But they can drive the conversation, the political agenda, the cultural agenda still for a large part of the country. And there the issue of story selection is so important, because they just choose, you know, if it's the New York Times or CNN or the Washington Post or whatever, you know, they choose to do particular stories about the Trump administration. By the way, many of those stories, I've got an issue with a lot of the reporting on the Trump administration, but a lot of the stories are not necessarily intrinsically false, but it's that they chose to do those stories rather than other stories they could have done, that I think has so driven the agenda and has so, so driven public impressions of the Trump administration, or indeed of the conservative movement, or indeed of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think you just did a great job of explaining the narrative monopoly, right? And if you want to visualize it, an interesting way to think about it, at least in my mind, is a bid-ask spread, you know, on a stock where you have the red and the green and they're just pushing at each other. Well, they have all of the buying power on a narrative, and they're just completely overtaking anyone who is pushing against it. And I think, you know, you hit on this earlier in that point, was that a lot of the bias is unconscious. And I totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, I have friends who are journalists. I mean, there's no hiding the fact that most journalists are liberals, and that's just a fact. But that does not mean that they are out to defraud people or convince people otherwise. But I do think that the way that the incentives work make it so it is unconscious. So if you want to advance, if you're at Huffington Post, or you're at BuzzFeed, or you're at kind of a second tier publication and you want to make it to the New York Times, you have to kind of play the game, right? Like, you have to retweet what Maggie Haberman is saying. You have to, you know, whatever story is big, you gotta gang up on it. And that's where the unconscious piece of it is. You know, I don't think that they're sitting there thinking like, oh yeah, well, this one's going to really get Republicans or really get conservatives or whatever it is. I think it's just like, okay, we're, you know, somebody out there in the ether set this agenda, and now we gotta pile on.
I think you're absolutely right. I think most of the biases, I'm sure there are some people who are nakedly pursuing an agenda and deliberately choosing stories, you know, to pursue that agenda. But I think most journalists, you're absolutely right. The vast majority of journalists at mainstream media organizations are liberal, and they kind of don't even realize it. And one of the reasons they don't realize it is, like, there's a, you know, familiar with one of the great French works of literature, Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme by Molière, which is a, you know, satire on someone, you know, who is a middle class and wants to become, you know, an aristocrat, and is taught by people the right way to behave. And one of the famous lines from that book is, you know, his French teacher, his literature teacher, explains to him the difference between poetry and prose. You know, and he explains what poetry is, and, you know, he says, what is poetry? And then he says, what is not poetry is prose. And then he explains to him that this gentleman has been speaking prose all his life. And he says, oh my God, really? That's amazing. I've been speaking prose all my life. I didn't realize that. And he's really excited about the fact that he's been speaking prose all his life. That's what journalists are like. They live among liberals. They spend their entire life among progressives who have the same view. They go to colleges where almost everyone around them is a progressive. They go into major media organizations where everyone around, their friends all think alike. Their acquaintances all think alike. I mean, it is a very, you know, it's not, it's become a bit of a cliche, but that's, you know, there was a sort of, you know, somebody asked that question a few years ago, and I think somebody may even have done a study of it. How many journalists, not only how many of the journalists and mainstream media organizations voted for Donald Trump, how many of them know anyone who voted for Donald Trump? And it's an astonishingly small number. There, I guarantee you, I know people, you know, many, many people in major news organizations, including ones that I've worked at, who probably have never actually, you know, except in a sort of, you know, in a kind of anthropological way, where they might have been sent out somewhere to meet Trump voters in the way that you might send colonialists used to go out, send parties out to meet the kind of, to meet the natives, to see what they were like out there and how, what they were, whether they were dangerous or friendly or whatever. That's the kind of attitude towards Trump voters, towards conservatives, towards people who feel kind of understandably disenfranchised and alienated from the system. Oh, who are these people? Let's go out and find them. That's the only contact they have with these people. They don't have normal social or professional contact with people who don't think like themselves. So of course they're not. So of course it's not a conscious bias. So of course when they write, about abortion, social issues like abortion or gun control, or when they write about, attitudes towards race, and racial awareness and racial justice and things like that. Those people all think of it. Of course they don't think that what they're doing is like consciously promoting an agenda. It's just the life that they live. It's just what their entire environment, their entire experience is, and they're just putting it out there. And that's so much of the problem with modern media and the narrative that you describe, is that this narrative is constructed by people who live a particular way of life, and it is completely separate from, distinct from, and again, unfortunately, this is the real problem, sees itself as dramatically superior to the lives of so many Americans who live differently and who think differently. And if it were just the problem in this country right now, is, and in other countries too, to some extent, is not just the people live differently. It's that one group of people really believes that it is the enlightened group of people, that it is animated by reason and science and wisdom and goodness and virtue and all of those things. And there's a group of people out there somewhere who they don't really want to meet unless they have to go on a journalistic assignment to meet them, who are stupid and unreasoning and uneducated and bad. And that's where this whole problem of, which is just accelerating, which has just accelerated over the last 30 years, the whole problem of a very narrow-minded media narrative that is contributing to the problems in this country, that's where it comes from.
Yeah, I think, there's a good anecdote from Robert Caro in an interview about when he was researching the Senate race between Johnson and Coke Stevenson. And when he went down there to interview people about it was some alleged corruption with Coke Stevenson, and everyone he interviewed couldn't produce any evidence. And the only thing that they said was everyone knows that he did this.
Right.
And he goes on to say, once I dug in, it was just, someone at some point had spread this rumor, and it just became capital C, capital K, common knowledge.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't true. And I think that has to do a lot with this line of thinking. The other thing is, researching the history of journalism, it really used to be a blue collar job. There used to be, people at the Dayton Daily News who that was their livelihood. They worked there their whole life. They got their pension, and it was it also made money because they own the distribution and all that stuff we don't have to go into. But now that the media is almost entirely supported, or increasingly supported, I should say, by subscribers, that in my opinion creates more of an echo chamber as well. I think there is a narrative out there that if you have subscribers that you control your own destiny. I don't think that's true. I think that actually makes you more dependent upon a certain kind of line of thinking that got those people to subscribe in the first place.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And what you say about journalism being originally like a sort of a craft, essentially done by people who were trained to do the craft, and whose only interest literally was getting out there and finding out a story, and whether it was what crimes were committed last night in Detroit or Houston or whatever, or whether it was what did the president say yesterday, and what do other people say about that, and what's going on, what is actually the administration really doing, what are we what's the real policy here behind the public statements. That was what motivated them. I think beginning in about the 1960s, there are a number of obviously major things going on at the time. Obviously, the changes of the 1960s were the movement, the civil rights movement, and the kind of social and economic changes that occurred in the 1960s were part of this. And then suddenly newspapers became instead people by graduates of very smart universities. And they weren't going into journalism. They weren't going into anything to tell other people what had happened. They were going to tell people what to think. You know, they were smart, educated people, or at least they thought they were smart. They were educated people whose job they saw it as being, you know, to educate and to guide and to lead, instead of becoming people who were sort of observers of the world. They were leaders. They wanted to lead. And then, you know, the number of things that Watergate was an absolutely critical turning point in this. It created, again, it is, you know, there'd always been the sort of narrative of the journalist as hero. There were, you know, great films back to, you know, Ace in the Hole and all those things back in the 1950s and 60s. But suddenly, you know, a lot of those were fiction. Suddenly, you had this cinematic moment of Watergate where, you know, a bad president did bad things and it was exposed by good journalism. And suddenly journalism became this, wow, this amazing opportunity to be a, you know, cloaked hero, a superhero saving the world from villains. And it was no longer just about going and finding out what's happening and, yes, exposing wrongdoing and all of that. It became this opportunity to change the world in the way that Woodward and Bernstein did. And that further encouraged and, you know, drew, incentivized many, many more people with, you know, large agendas and large egos to go into journalism. And, you know, it kind of ends in the sort of terrible spectacle of people like Jim Acosta, you know, standing up at White House press briefings, making sure that he is the star. And that, you know, so that process that began, that evolved from journalism being a craft where people tried to find out what was going on, evolved through, you know, this influx of educated people, if Watergate, and then, as I say, right up to now, where I'm afraid, you know, it's all about the journal. It's all about the journalism. It's all about the journal. In fact, it's not about the journalism. It's about the journalists. And that's a very sorry state of affairs.
How would you say, how would you describe the difference between the British press and the American press? Because I know that they're a little bit more open about where they're coming from over there, right?
Yeah. So there are a number of differences. I think on the whole, it's fair to say that American journalists are better trained. They are better, again, for major news organizations. I'm talking. So if you take, you know, the top half a dozen major newspapers in this country, digital or print, whatever, let's say top 10 maybe, and their counterparts in the UK. I think on the whole, those journalists here, you know, I didn't have any formal journalism training. I got a lot of good training on the job, particularly at the BBC and particularly at the BBC actually, but elsewhere too. But here, and again, you know, it's one of the great, I have to say, one of the great privileges of being editor of the Wall Street Journal is you hire people, you've got, you know, they have been really thoroughly trained. Now, some of it, I have an issue with a lot of the journalism training that goes on. And again, it's unfortunately nearly all bent towards the narrative that you've described. But there's no question that on basic, the training and the enforcement of the basic rules of reporting is much more rigorous. Both of them are much more rigorous in the US than they are here. You know, whether it's, you know, making sure you've got multiple sources.
I'm sorry, in the UK or
no, here in the United States. Here in the United, okay. I'm in the United States. Here, it's much more, American journalists are much more rigorously trained. And for the most part, although again, I'm sorry to say, I think this is diminishing rapidly, but for the most part still enforce the kind of standard principles and rules of journalism much better than they do in the UK. I think the UK, however, I think there is much less of a herd mentality in the UK. I think there is I think, again, one of the massive problems in the US right now is you have it to some extent on both sides, to be fair. It's obviously heavily dominated by the left, but even those kind of conservative, conservative or right of center news organizations that you have kind of tend to sort of flock together. But obviously the liberals dominate vastly the media landscape in this country, and they all move. They all think the same way, and they're all chasing the same story. And it seems one of my frustrations as an editor was often to say to people, look, we should be doing something different. If they're going that way, maybe we should be going this way. A, it's just more interesting to, because we're only going to probably do the same stuff that they're doing. And B, it's actually more valuable to, we'll produce something new and different that the reader actually, would actually matter to the reader. I think there is a tendency in among British journalists to be much more, to be more diverse, genuinely ideologically diverse. There's, the major newspapers in the UK tend to divide between, they are right-wing supporting papers and left-wing supporting papers, and the right with that, they're fairly evenly balanced in the way that they aren't in the US. The television media is different. It tends to lean left pretty strongly. So, but I think, but again, I think there's also in Britain, there's more of an independence and more of a almost kind of cussedness, really. And another critical dimension of that is a lack of deference. Now, there is obviously no deference in this country shown towards shown towards President Trump in particular, or maybe doesn't deserve it, but shown towards conservatives. But there's an extraordinary deference to the agenda, to the narrative here, to the, and I think part of the problem, for example, many journalistic problems in the last few decades. I do think that the Iraq War and the run-up to the Iraq War and the way in which the media in this country kind of got in line very quickly. Even again, this was a Republican president, developing an argument for and evidence for a war that, in the past you would think that, papers like the New York Times, it was a Republican president, and B, given what had happened in Vietnam and everything else, and the role that the New York Times had played in exposing some of the lies and failure of Vietnam, you would think they might be more skeptical, but they weren't. I don't know what happened. All of the papers tended to kind of fall into line after 9/11, obviously, and didn't really challenge the narrative. In the UK, that was very, very different. There was much less deference to the narrative, to the story, to the people who were promoting the story. And as a result, I think you've got a lot better journalism. So, so I think that is, again, I think American journalism on the whole, in terms of observing the rules and standards and procedures of journalism, are much more rigorous. I do, however, think that British journalism is much more independent and much more, much less deferential and much more willing to challenge the prevailing view, the prevailing orthodoxy than Americans are.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Iraq War example, because this podcast is not simply on a right-left spectrum. The Iraq War is a great example of a narrative gone wrong, where data and reason and, diligence would have saved a lot of lives, saved trillions of dollars. And that is, that is the downside of a narrative. With respect to the British media, it seems as though, and this is from a 30,000 foot perspective, I have not read a ton about this, but it seems as though now that Brexit is complete, the political climate over there is the temperature is coming down a bit compared to, we're taping this in mid-January, compared with the storming of the Capitol that just happened. So is the media landscape over there, what you just described in that last answer, does that have anything to do with the fact that the temperature is coming down?
It's I've thought a lot about this, Jeff, in the last few weeks. And look, not to get into too much detail about the post-election, challenges and things the president has said since the election, but part of the, for the record, I think while there are legitimate questions about the way the election was conducted, particularly the expansion of mail-in voting in ways in some states that was frankly looks to me, at least from my little understanding of the Constitution, looks unconstitutional in those states. And there are really legitimate questions about how much postal voting went on. That said, to overturn an election like that, you have to have evidence. You have to be able to present the evidence to courts and to demonstrate, clear evidence of malfeasance in a way that affected the result. I just didn't see it. I haven't seen it. 90 judges haven't seen it. All of that. So that all that said, and I think the president is wrong to have done what he did. I think wrong to do what he did. last week, all of that. So
I mean, I have no problem saying what he's done post-election is an abject disgrace.
That said, I completely agree with you. That said, part of the defense of the president, it's not really defense, but it's a kind of, you know, it's part of the whataboutery that we haven't, you know, got so much of this, is not unreasonable, which is the Democrats spent a long time after the 2016 election denying President Trump's legitimacy. You know, remember one of them, of course, and, you know, since we're talking about storming the Capitol, one Democratic senator actually challenged, the Democratic Senate didn't challenge the results, but Hillary Clinton repeatedly said, although she accepted the results formally, repeatedly went around saying President Trump wasn't a legitimate president. Most of the media went around saying he wasn't legitimate. They did pursue a narrative for 3 years that said that they colluded with the Russians, and of course in a close election, which it was, the Russians had basically, you know, there are many, many, many people who have spent the last 4 years arguing that Donald Trump is an illegitimate president because whether or not he willingly colluded, the Russians helped him win. That's, you know, in my view, that's bullshit. But that's the view. So there was this undermining of Donald Trump for 4 years. And I understand the frustration and the anger that a lot of Republican voters feel and Trump voters feel about what happened in 2020, given what had happened in 2016. But just to your point, but of course, you know, this is exactly what happened in the UK after Brexit. The Brexit referendum happened in, and by the way, the numbers are quite fascinatingly similar. In 2016, the British people voted to leave the European Union by a margin of about 52% to 48%. It was close, but clear. By the way, 52 to 48 is exactly what Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by in November, almost exactly what he beat Donald Trump by. So, you know, not a landslide by any means, but a solid margin of victory. Then after 2016, after the referendum in 2016, for 3 years, 3.5 years, the British establishment, by which I mean large parts of the political establishment, half the ruling Conservative Party was against Brexit, and almost all of the Labour Party and most other opposition parties. The media, heavily against Brexit. The City of London, big business. Everybody who had a loud voice, who had influence, spent the next 3 years literally trying to undo the referendum result. You know, they were doing it, they would argue through constitutional means, but they were trying to do it. They were trying to get a second referendum to overturn it. And if they couldn't get a second referendum, they were trying to water down Brexit to legislatively to the point where it would be almost meaningless. So, you know, again, without in any way defending what President Trump did at the Capitol in the 2 weeks before the inauguration, it does annoy me when I hear people saying, oh my God, how can you not accept the result of an election, you know, the left, unfortunately, with Brexit in 2016 and with Trump's election in 2016, has been actively, concertedly, deliberately undermining and trying effectively in both cases to undo the results of a democratic election. And that is a problem. So they have, to some extent, you know, laid the framework for what we've been seeing in the last couple of months. Let me be clear once again, I don't defend what President Trump's done, but they have, the left have laid the groundwork for that. Now, again, your point about Brexit is a good one, Jeff. But what finally happened in Britain, why we've got, you know, dreaded word closure in Britain is finally Boris Johnson, to his great credit, came in, finally was elected after the chaos that was going on. And came in the middle of 2019 and said, I'm going to do Brexit. The British people voted for it. We're not going to water it down. We're going to have a real Brexit, going to get it done, and it's going to happen. Called a general election, which the British Prime Minister can basically do, in late 2019, December 2019, and won a genuine landslide, the biggest conservative victory since the 1980s, settled it. Okay, it was settled. It was done. At that point, the Labour Party said, you know what? Almost everybody at that point finally said, okay, it's done, it's over. You have been able to get closure. And again, we've still spent a lot of the last year negotiating. Finally, you know, the deal was finally done. The post-Brexit deal was negotiated, and now Britain is out of the EU and out of the single market and all of those arrangements, all that kind of stuff. So it did take tremendous leadership, which Boris Johnson was able to show to his credit. It took one of, I think one of the problems here in the US that you have, and again, I do think now, and it's quite striking that the Labour leader now, the new Labour leader in Britain, Keir Starmer, has said it's over. You know, we're not, you know, there is this movement to rejoin, which is, you know, supported by a small, by a minority of the population. But he's saying, I don't want anything to do with, we're not doing that. We're not going to rejoin. There'll be an election in Britain in 2024. And we're going to, you know, we're not going to campaign to rejoin the EU. It's over. It's done. We're going to make the best of Brexit. We didn't like it. We didn't want it, but it's happening. There has been an acceptance. And unfortunately, I do think one of the challenges in America right now is you don't get to a position where people accept on either side. Again, after 2016, a large number of Democrats in the media did not accept the outcome of that election. They thought it was illegitimate. 2020, large numbers of Trump supporters, large numbers of the Republican Party, again, in my view, wrongly, don't accept the outcome of that election. And I think, I don't know what, frankly, what the answer is. I think part of the problem, and this is, sorry, more of the problem rather than solution, I think part of the problem is that in America, it's both the strength and the weakness of the Constitution, right? The great strength of the Constitution is that, you know, you have a much more pluralist system. You have, a federal system, where 50 states have tremendous autonomy over their own rules. You have separation of powers in Washington, in the federal government, where, you know, you have an executive which you can have an executive of one party. But frankly, even if you have an executive that controls the Congress, as we're about to have with the Democrats, there's still tremendous individual power rested in each of those things. And that's a great thing in many ways, because it means you don't, you know, you, as the founders were trying to do, they were avoiding a situation where any branch of any faction would gain too much power. In Britain has exactly the opposite, right? Britain, if you win a general election, the government has a pliant majority in the House of Commons. It can basically do almost whatever it likes, it gets done. That is a democratic tyranny, a tyranny of the majority of people have called it in the past. And that's, you know, has its weaknesses. In situations like this, it's actually, maybe it's, you know, it's not a bad thing. Britain has got that done. It's over. But there's no constitutional framework for sort of continuing a kind of a challenge to or for offering an alternative. I do think at a time when the country is so divided in the United States, that it is the separation of powers and the pluralism and the federalism of the United States is further weakening, because you get to the situation where, you know, kind of like nobody ever has to say we lost. Again, in Britain December 2019, the Labour Party said we lost. We lost. We argued to stay in the EU. We argued for a whole bunch of other things. We got our asses kicked. We lost. It's over. Nobody in America sort of says that anymore, and partly because they don't have to, because there'll be a Senate election, there'll be a congressional election in 2 years' time, and very likely the Republicans will win back control of the Congress. There will, you know, the Republicans, you know, again, the result of the 2020 election was actually pretty much a split decision. I know in the end, you know, Democrats won the Senate and the White House, but they lost a lot of seats in the House. They didn't gain as many seats as they thought they would in the Senate, and they lost a lot in state houses. So the very strength of pluralism can, at a time when there's so much factionalism in the country and so much partisanship, can also be a weakness. And I think this is the problem right now with America. I think you have a situation where nobody ever has to confront the consequences of actually losing. And you're seeing it. And again, this particular phenomenon right now with Trump is that, you know, Trump supporters are basically not saying, you know, a lot of them are saying we lost and whatever, but a huge number of Republicans are saying we didn't lose, we were cheated, it was wrong. It's not, so they don't have to come to terms with a new democratic reality. And I think that is the difference right now between the United States and Britain.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because what I kind of hear you saying is almost that British politicians are more principled, in a sense.
I'm not sure. It's an interesting way to put it. I wouldn't put it in those. I put it this way. I think that when they lose an election, see, again, one of the problems in Britain was we had a referendum in 2016, and then you had a kind of inconclusive. Now, you know, it was inconclusive that Britain had a parliamentary election a year later. Which resulted in what they call a hung parliament, which, you know, where the Conservatives lost their majority, didn't have enough of a majority. So you had inconclusiveness, and that's one of the reasons we had the mess over Brexit. Then in 2019, Britain, the Conservatives won a clear majority in parliament. And I think what happened is what happens is that rather than being more principled, I think they're more, they understand that acknowledging the reality is going to be better for them in the long run. I mean, the Labour lost in 2019, partly because of Brexit and partly because it had a terrible sort of like socialist, extreme socialist leader. And they were able to say, you know, they got rejected in traditional parts of the country that the Conservatives that had never won before, the so-called red wall, as they call it, confusingly in British politics, red and blue are opposite. You know, red is the left-wing party, the Labour Party, and blue is the Conservative Party. There was a red wall, which Labour, you know, a bit like the kind of industrial Midwest here, as we used to call it, there was a northern part of England which voted election after election after election for Labour and reliable exit. Conservatives won those seats in 2019, largely because of Brexit, because those parts of the country voted heavily for Brexit. The political reality, I say, rather than being principled, that the leader of the Labour Party saw this political reality and just said, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to keep losing here if we continue to insist that the Brexit was wrong and we shouldn't do it. So acceding to the reality of politics because you have to, and because it's the only way you're ever probably going to get elected again and do things you want to do, is, I think, one of the things that is one of the differences between Britain and the US. I do think there's something else I should say, though. And again, I don't think it's about principle. I do slightly worry that the way politics is evolving in this country is it kind of doesn't matter for a lot of people, like whether you win or lose. For a lot of Trump supporters, I think we're almost in a situation where it's like they believe they were cheated and they believe they should have won. But I think that purity and adherence to the cause is kind of more important than winning an election these days. And that actually, I think that is a problem. And by the way, you've seen that in Britain too in the past. It's often a phenomenon on the left. It's not a phenomenon of conservative parties, which tend to be quite pragmatic. It's a phenomenon of ideological parties where they say, look, if I have to make compromises with the electorate in order to win an election, I'm not interested because I believe in, you know, socialism or whatever. And I think, unfortunately, we're in that position right now. I think a lot of Republicans are so completely alienated and angry and disaffected with the system that they think the system, frankly, isn't working. I think to some extent, without in any way excusing anybody who did that terrible storming of the Capitol last week, that's part of what they're doing, right? It's partly, they didn't think it was wrong because they think it's failed. They think the system has failed them and it needs to be literally torn down. Again, not in any way defending it. So I think, again, that's a measure of the dysfunction now and of the alienation and of the mistrust that Americans have, that many Americans have in their political system. And that isn't particularly, there is some of that in Britain, but again, because of the clarity that is brought about by an election in Britain, as happened, those sentiments have less opportunity to surface and to become important political forces.
Right. I think the chord you're striking here is the difference in their political system, simply put. One of the things that I really think about is the friction between the way that our Constitution sets up our government and federalism and our information sphere now, right? So everyone is consuming a nonstop feed of what is, in some sense, globalized, but really it's nationalized information, right? So if you're living in Santa Barbara or if you're living in Columbus, you're basically getting the same set of information. And how that impacts what you're talking about with the purity test and, you know, people, the kind of over-reliance on, or not over-reliance, but the efficacy of primaries in our election system now is a product of voters voting on these national issues that they're getting from this national information sphere. Whereas 50, 100 years ago, your senator was really important because they were going to do something for your state. They were going to go to Washington and they were going to, you know, represent your state and fight for those issues. Now it's, how did you vote on abortion? Or how did you vote on whatever the nationalized issue of the day is? And it has no relevance to the state. Mm-hmm. But their job still is relevant to their state and their district. I think one thing that you alluded to but didn't quite say was that we'd all be a bit better off if power was more diffuse, if it was pushed down into local communities. I think a lot of times you read online or you see talking heads saying, what are we going to do? You know, it's never what am I going to do? It's always this general sense of what are we, like all 330 million people, going to do? Society's a lot more complex than that.
But I think that's one of the reasons, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it is one of the defining differences, unfortunately, between, it always has been to some extent, between left and right, right? I mean, conservatives, generally speaking, favor federalism and devolution and subsidiarity, the principle that, you know, decisions should be made at the lowest possible level. Democrats have always, you know, favored, you know, operating, you know, from a top-down approach and having more kind of compliance with kind of national values. And I think that tendency now, I think, whereas one of the weird things that's happened with a lot of Republicans in the last few months is they've kind of gone in the opposite direction and this sort of, you know, challenging the election and, you know, trying to get a situation where, you know, the Congress can overturn the results of a, you know, election which is constitutionally mandated to be a matter of the states. That's a bizarre situation, but that's a kind of a, that's an odd one-off. I think the bigger, one of the reasons for the bigger political tension and partisanship and discord in this country is that the Democrats, and particularly in the last year with, you know, with the Black Lives Matter and the protests and the riots and to some extent the pandemic, that's kind of brought to a kind of a, to a head the tendency that Democrats have had for the last, you know, 20, 30 years of liberal progress, let's call them progressives because it's not very liberal increasingly, progressives have had to kind of impose their values on the whole country, you know, and it's, and I think that's where we are really, you know, butting up against real, you know, and we are laying the groundwork for real potential trouble here, because I think it's, you know, you right at the start, so not you, but other people, you know, we talked about this right at the start, but people have made this, you know, the progressive march of the last 30 years, which has steadily expanded and imposed progressive values on the nation, whether it, you know, began with what most people would accept is right, which is the civil rights movement and the, you know, the removal of those, you know, completely obscene barriers to Black participation through segregation and Jim Crow laws and all that kind of stuff. It began with that. It advanced then through abortion and, you know, the women's rights movement, and it has become, and you know, it's, we've got to this situation now where the progressive orthodoxy, whether it is on, by the way, going way beyond, of course, the, you know, the elimination of segregation and Jim Crow, to you've now got to sign on to the view that you're a white supremacist unless you, you know, you're a racist, you know, unless you, if you know, that famous sort of trap that if you deny that you're a racist, you're a racist because you're in self and because you're in denial. And if you're a racist, if you accept you're a racist, good, but you're a racist. You know, so we've gone to that point, and we've gone to the point where, you know, again, we've gone to the extreme. I do think that, you know, the gay marriage, for example, you know, I think the speed of these changes, you know, we've gone from a situation where literally Barack Obama, you know, as late as I think 2010, was still openly opposed to gay marriage, to a situation literally within like 5 or 6 years where if you oppose gay marriage, you were a bigot, you know, on par with, you know, slave owners. I mean, quite literally, there were people making that argument about, as it happens, I'm fine with gay marriage, but a lot of people who, you know, whose religious or cultural views that had been the mainstream just a few years before, vast majority of Americans were now being told that they held hideously unacceptable views, so that if you were a baker who, you know, held views and you didn't want to bake a cake, it is far beyond, you know, allowing people to get married in a state, or two people who loved each other and wanted to get married in a state, completely fine. We were now in, this is the problem with the progressive orthodoxy, that it's now got to the point where if you're a baker who doesn't want to actually, you know, you're not stopping those people getting married, you're not protesting those people getting married, you're not doing whatever you can to infringe on their rights, you, if you don't want to bake them a cake because you don't approve of the union, too bad, you can be forced to bake them a cake. This is So I think this is where, you know, so much of the tension comes about, this progressive agenda, whether it's on race, gender, the transgender issues that we're seeing, whether it is on sexuality, whether it is on some of these other issues, and it can extend into other areas too. This tendency to overrule the traditions of American pluralism and federalism and say, no, you've got to subscribe to this, and not just subscribe to it, but actually we can make you take part in it. We can actually force you to participate in this, you know, or Catholic nuns being required to offer contraception to people who work for them in profound contravention of their religious beliefs. That religious agenda, that progressive agenda, and it is kind of, by the way, quasi-religious, but that's another topic. But that progressive agenda is butting up against, you know, against real resistance. And I think, yeah, large part of the reason Donald Trump was elected, it's a large part of the reason people are so fearful of what democratic control means and why they're so determined to insist that Donald Trump, you know, actually did win the election. So I think that is again where we're storing up tremendous amounts of trouble for the country. And I do have no doubt, you know, I've been very critical of, you know, right wingers who refuse to accept the result of the election, who say, you know, Donald Trump's been cheated, and who say, you know, the system, you know, that Democrats are evil and, you know, trying to destroy the government. I've been critical of those people, but I am absolutely sure that many of those people who fear that this encroaching progressive, you know, orthodoxy is being imposed across the country. And I think that is a source of a large part of the tension in the country. And it fits it's absolutely promulgated by the media in the narrative. That's, you know, it is the, again, if you're not actively in favor of Black Lives Matter, I mean, this is a good example. It's not just enough anymore to say, I'm totally against racial discrimination. Of course, I believe in integration of schools. I believe African-Americans and minorities should have every single right that white people have. Of course, I passionately believe that. Sure, you do. Sure, frankly, most conservatives in this country absolutely believe that. It's not enough. You've now got to say, no. I'm sorry, that's not enough. You've got to acknowledge your own racism. You've got to deny America the virtues of American history. You've got to subscribe to whole sets of language and behavior and everything else that is designed, that is actually, as very many people have rightly pointed out, fundamentally racist in nature, because it's saying we're going to elevate one race. We are going to treat people on the basis of their skin color. Those of us who used to consider ourselves, you know, do still consider ourselves anti-racist, we're being told, no, we're not anti-racist anymore because we're not subscribing to that agenda. That is, you know, again, and we've seen that advance so much in the last year. And you listen to people like, not so much Joe Biden, although he says it, but people like Kamala Harris say these things, and it understandably alarms people.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the creation of these binaries of racist, anti-racist, I mean, that's literally the plot from 1984. Right. There's no way around it. It's good or bad. And a huge problem I have with the news media is this lack of nuance. And that's the problem with these narratives, is there's no nuance. And, you know, exactly what you're talking about, where someone 5 years ago had this mainstream view that's now completely unorthodox. And now they're a Nazi. And it's just like, what are you talking about? These are real people with a diverse set of views. I think Republicans winning down ballot, I would imagine, is a large product of that. The fact that, you know, people rejected Trump, and they also rejected a lot of what they saw over the summer of the exact orthodoxy that you're talking about. And when you're talking about, you know, how the media plays a role in this too, outside of the lack of nuance, which we can get into. A great example of this was Coinbase, the company, coming out and saying, you know what, we're just sick of this politics. We don't want politics in our company. Something that someone transported from 10 years ago would say, okay, that's reasonable, right? Like, I don't want to be clashing with people in my company about politics all the time. I just want to focus on what the company hired me to do. But as you say, it's about this moral superiority where, you know, oh, we're just objectively right, and you can't hold these other views. And that's what that's predicated on, right? They're saying, oh, it's not political. Coinbase, what Coinbase is doing is it's not political because this is an accepted truth. And the media, so the New York Times, just like clockwork, writes a hit piece about Coinbase. And I think they wrote two, and it didn't go anywhere because it was pretty obviously trash. There were stories that they dug up that I think the company addressed that weren't great, but they were trying to drum up this narrative that they were a racist company, and it's just not true. It's just false. And the fact that you knew with an absolute certainty that once they put that memo out that they weren't going to be political, you were going to see the hit piece.
Yeah,
it's really disheartening, especially someone who has a reverence for the role of the press in the Fourth Estate.
Yeah,
but the lack of nuance, I think, is really what I'd like to hear from you, because you know, you sat in that seat. How do we get back to that place where there is nuance in these conversations? Because it's just black and white right now.
Well, let me give you an example of what you're talking about, and I'll address this, the nuance question, it's because it's a difficult one. But, and you know, I don't want to talk too much about my own experience as editor of the Wall Street Journal, or indeed where I am right now as an opinion writer on the page of the Wall Street Journal. But I will talk about this one, which is, This is an example of how the goalposts have moved so far, and the agenda, the progressive agenda, has become so dominant in the media, as well as you just pointed out, things like corporate, that with that Coinbase story, with, you know, it's become increasingly part of corporate orthodoxy too. But I give you a little examples, and an example of where the how the goalposts have moved, and how constraining it can be. And how for conservatives, I wrote at the beginning, as the Black Lives Matter protests were getting underway last summer. I was still writing a column at that point. I stepped down as editor of the journal just over 2 years ago. I was then became a columnist. I was writing a column for the weekend section of the paper, which is still part of the news pages of the paper. I was writing a kind of an analytical column. It wasn't an opinion column, but I was writing an analytical column. And I wrote a piece in last June when those, I was in the process of discussing moving to the opinion pages anyway. And I did straight after this, but so I wrote a column that last summer in which I said that, quoting the data, that I argued that the narrative that the Black Lives Matter movement and its supporters in the media were putting about, that what defined the lives of so many African Americans in this country was a kind of constant fear of being murdered by police officers, was, I think, you know, was an exaggeration. That while there's absolutely injustice, and while in many, many cases of, of bad police behavior, racist police behavior, the reality was rather different. And actually, that the if you look at the data for the number of, you know, blacks killed by police, whites killed by police, more blacks are killed by police officers, it's true. But actually, in terms of if you weight that by the number of encounters that black people have with police, it's actually, you know, white people are killed disproportionately. It's slightly the proportion of white people who have an encounter with the police that are killed by the police is slightly higher than the proportion of black people who have an encounter with the police. So my argument was, the argument of this piece was, you know, first of all, let's stop the kind of, you know, silliness that there's a genocide of black people going on in the country by racist police officers. That's just silly. And secondly, let's look a little more detail. Let's look in more detail at why it is that there are so many encounters. There are so many more encounters between black people and police. And it could be absolutely all those things that we know about: economic disadvantage and, social disadvantage, and all the other things that go on. All these, there are many, many factors. It's not all about the police, was my argument. And I said, and on top of also, of course, that I pointed out that the other number that everybody's familiar with, that far, far, far more black people are killed by other black people than are killed by white people, be they police officers or anything else. And this, you know, terrible, terrible tragedy of black America, the overwhelming tragedy of lives lost for black people in cities in America is that they are lost in violent crime committed by, sadly, other black people. That's not, you know, anyway, I wrote this piece. This was denounced as racist. I don't consider remotely, I don't think I don't think people should be judged by their race, by their racial identity, by their ethnicity. I absolutely do believe that you can't live in, you can't know anything about this country and not know about the racial history in this country to know that blacks have suffered unbelievable, persecution and injustice in this country, and that much needs to be done to put that right. I believe all of those things. But you also have to acknowledge that there is this problem of violence committed for whatever reason. I wasn't even like saying it's because black people are more prone to violence. Far from it. I have no idea what the reasons are. There are all kinds of reasons for it. That is almost certainly isn't the one. It's all to do with all kinds of other reasons. But we have to acknowledge that this is a huge problem. You can argue about police problem, the police brutality and that stuff too. That's fair. There are examples of that. But there is this enormous problem of black people killing black people in cities because of crime and all that's to do, again, whether it's to do with deprivation or family structure or all this kind of stuff. That does need to be addressed. That is now unsayable in the media, in most of the media. You are not allowed to say that in the media. There was an outcry from my own colleagues on the news side of the Wall Street Journal because I wrote that. And by the way, not, I have to stress, Wall Street Journal colleagues afterwards, but I was denounced on social media as a racist for making that point. That's where we've got to. And that, you know, I don't want to, it's not all about me, for God's sake, but that you can't make an argument which challenges the Black Lives Matter narrative, which, by the way, as we know, much of it, you know, much of that Black Lives Narrative Matter is false. The beginning with the shooting of the guy in Ferguson, Missouri, and the whole fiction that was built up around that he was, you know, hands up, don't shoot. A lot of that is false. You can't challenge that. You can't, if you challenge that, it's denounced as racism. And it's, and of course, racism, nobody accepts racism. Any racist needs to be, you know, excluded from polite society. That's back to the earlier point we were talking about, the advance of the progressive, the steady encroachment of progressive orthodoxy into all kinds of new ways. It's no longer enough to say, I'm absolutely against discrimination. I'm absolutely in favor of investigating instances of police brutality against black people. It's not enough to say that. You've got to say that, you know, you're not allowed to say that there is a problem. There might be other problems that afflict the black community in this country. That is deemed racist. And I was pummeled by my own colleagues, by other people in the media for saying that kind of thing. That's a problem. And that's why so many people feel angry about it. The point about nuance. So again, and I sort of highlighted that point in part to make the point about, you know, this issue is a nuanced one. It is, of course, to go back to what I said and to repeat it so there's no misunderstanding when people see this and say, oh my God, what is it saying? There is racial inequality in this country. There is racial injustice in this country. Pressing, it is a pressing problem. It needs to be addressed. There is racism in all kinds of institutions in this country. Thank God, less than there was. It's getting better, but it's still a problem and it needs to be addressed. There are other problems, however, and not all the problems in this country that affects black people are the result of racism. You can't say that. This is, and again, this is where the nuance problem comes about. You know, the nuanced and truthful observation about race is there is terrible racism in this country and it needs to be addressed. But there are also other issues. There are issues to do with, you know, and there are fabulous, you know, African-American writers on this, Glenn Lowry, you know, the professor at Brown University, what's his name, John McWhirter at Columbia, African-Americans who are addressing these issues and saying, we have to address those issues. Not every instance of black disadvantage in this country is the result of white persecution. But if you say that, Jeff, if you say that, you are now deemed to be a racist. If you don't accept the narrative promulgated by the media that every single problem that seriously affects black people in this country is the result of white supremacy and white prejudice and racism, you are judged a racist. And and again, there's problems with the nuances on the right too. I absolutely accept that. It's, you know, it's, of course, it's, take this recent issue of the banning by technology companies, which we've just been seeing this week, of conservative voices. President Trump off Twitter, the denial of access essentially to Parler, the rival to Twitter, all of those things. I think that's a terrible thing. I think, first of all, I think it's a mistake. You know, as Napoleon supposedly once said of it, you know, something, some awful thing that happened, it was worse than a crime. It's a mistake. I think it's a mistake. I think they're doing a terrible thing. I think they're driving a lot of voices underground and they'll regret it. And we will regret it as a society. I also, however, think it's, there needs to be a bit more, it's not I think it's wrong and they shouldn't do it. And I think something, you know, needs to be addressed about it. But I think also conservatives need to acknowledge there are people on some of these platforms who are saying absolutely obscene and outrageous things. And we probably shouldn't have a situation where we allow them. I think it's fine to say, I think it's even fine to go out there and say, by the way, the election was stolen from President Trump. I think it's wrong. I think it's false. I think it's demonstrably false. But I don't think people should be stopped from saying that, okay? I don't think I should be denied the right to say that on any major platform. But if you go out there and say, as a lot of people were doing on the Parler platform, you know, the election's been stolen, the country's been stolen from us, we got a list of, you know, people we're going to start taking out, right? These are the enemies of the people. We're going to take them out in the media, in politics, in, you know, whatever. Here's a list of people and they might start doxing them, whatever. That's unacceptable. And there's no question that there were, unfortunately, both on social, on all social media platforms, there were people doing that. So I'm just saying this to make the point that nuance is necessary. So when, you know, people are, you know, removed from some of these platforms, it's not simply progressive authoritarianism saying we want to get rid of these people. I do think that is a problem, a real problem. And as I've explained, and our whole conversation has been about, there is this progressive orthodoxy that they are promoting and it's steadily excluding other voices. There are complications too. There are nuances, which is that there are people out there saying things they shouldn't be saying. And there are genuine, by the way, genuine, in my view, racists who are out there, white supremacists who are genuinely white supremacists, not people who refuse to accept the orthodoxy of the New York Times. They're genuine white supremacists, and we need to do something about those people. But your point is exactly right, that this denial of nuance and this simplification of every single topic so that, you know, you're either a racist or you're not a racist. You're either, well, actually, that's true. But we've redefined racism to mean basically what certain people want it to mean. There is no scope for saying, look, there are problems in this, really profound problems in this country caused by individuals and people who are doing bad things. But there are other problems that are caused by people doing other bad things. And we need to step back a bit and take a look in the round and try and reintroduce a degree of, even if not nuanced, and just be a little bit more comprehensive. I mean, part of being a proper journalist is widening the net and having the curiosity to go and find out, maybe beyond your little narrow circle of friends, to start out what we started with, to find out what other things are going on. And maybe you'll find that things are not quite as simplistic. Maybe that person out there that you've denounced as a racist because he said something, maybe he isn't a racist at all. Or maybe he's not a, you know, homophobe or a, you know, or hates women. And by the way, on the right, again, maybe that person isn't a communist, you know, because he, you know, thinks that we should have a public, you know, publicly funded healthcare system. Go out and find out and be a little bit more curious and open to the possibility that your views are not 100% correct all of the time.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think that a big point that you just touched on is the indictment of everyone else's intentions. There's never a good faith argument anymore where someone says something that, you know, I may not have thought about, but my initial thought is, well, I'm just going to assume that they're a bad person. I'm just going to assume that they drown puppies and, you know, they just want the worst for the world and all of this stuff. And that in and of itself is really holding back a lot of the quote unquote solutions to the problems that we're describing. You know, when you talk about your op-ed about the, you know, about black on black violence and other problems there, you're just stating facts. You're just stating facts and you're not allowed to do that. And, you know, look, like I have no problem saying that Black Lives Matter. I have no problem saying that there are inequities in this society that need to be fixed, right? And anyone with two eyes and two ears, frankly, to listen to a lot of the people who, you know, have gotten to speak this year can understand that that's true. But when you get people saying that someone who said something 10 years ago that was a joke in their lowest moment is now the equivalent to a Klan member, or as you're saying, you know, someone who presents information that goes against the narrative is now the equivalent to a Klan's member. I mean, it's just not serious and it's not helpful. I would love nothing more to see these problems solved, but how are we going to solve them with no dialogue? And quite frankly, I don't believe a lot of the people that are bullying opposing views want to solve them. And I'm comfortable saying that. A huge problem in those communities is education. I mean, it's just every single school across the board in a lot of these inner cities, you get kids that get to, you know, high school and they're reading at like a third grade level. I mean, I have friends who are teachers in a couple inner city schools and they talk about it too. They're like, you know, these kids are screwed. And, you know, people who are for charter schools to fix that problem, which, you know, it reminds me of that. There's a West Wing episode, right? Where Charlie is like, he tells the president, and this is a Democratic president. He says, you know, I want to go to a charter school. Like, or I think he went to a charter school or something like that. Like, it's just obvious that yeah. charter schools work,
yeah.
but you don't see the proponents of charter schools, which would help a lot of Black children. You don't see them saying to the opponents of them that, oh, well, you're not for this because you're just racist. It's like, no, there's other reasons, right? If you're a member of the teachers union, you know, you may look at it through the prism of, well, I got to, you know, this in my personal lot as a teacher, you know, this is going to help me. I think the heads of teachers unions, that's probably a different story. We don't have to go into that. But again, it's just this lack of willingness to have a conversation. And I do think that on a local level, and I guess I mean an individual level, it just takes people to stand up and have this type of conversation and say, you know what, we're just not going to listen to you.
I agree. And look, I think another good example of that is attitudes towards COVID, right? And the response and the public health responses and policies towards COVID, right? You have a group of people who think that being made to wear a mask, or, you know, businesses, and again, don't get me wrong, again, and I've written about this, I think the damage done to the economy by lockdowns and the damage done more broadly to kind of social cohesion from some of the policies that a lot of these states have followed. I live in New York. It's, you know, I think it'll recover. I'm not one of those long-term pessimists, but it is dismal, absolutely dismal. And as bad as the COVID crisis was itself, and it was bad here, particularly coming up, obviously, again, now, the damage done to this city by lockdowns and the damage done to the spirit of the people and everything is terrible. So don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way saying, you know, I'm not a lockdown fanatic at all. And again, this is my point that there needs to be nuance here. But you get the people, you know, people who oppose lockdowns or oppose mask wearing saying, this is fascism. This is the government telling us what to do. This is mind control. This is, and you know, by the way, again, there are elements of that. There are certainly people, and I live in New York City under a mayor who would like, if he could, to be able to tell everybody what to do every second of their lives, right? I mean, just don't get me started on Bill de Blasio. There is definitely that left-wing authoritarianism, but a lot of it is, you know, public-spirited, decent people who really think that the best way to tackle this thing is that people really do need to wear a mask. They've seen some of the evidence. The evidence, I think, is mixed, but, you know, whatever. They're doing it out of a, they might be wrong, but they're not doing it out of a malevolent desire to crush freedom. And yet you get probably millions of people in this country who believe that they are. Let me say on the other, and again, just to be clear, I hate this on the one hand, on the other hand approach, I'll say it, but there is on the other side too. I then read people who say that, you know, if people don't wear masks, people are sort of mainly on the left, if people don't wear masks, they are killing people. They are willfully, deliberately pushing other people's lives at risk, and they should be treated at minimum as social pariahs, or perhaps they should actually be prosecuted for attempted homicide or something like that. That is also insane, okay? There are people who don't want to wear masks. Again, the evidence is pretty mixed. There are people who, you know, go out in the street where you're not going to get close to anybody, 10 feet away from anybody, and take their mask off briefly. You know, it's not, and again, they might be wrong, but their intentions are not malevolent. They are not trying to kill people. They are not defying people because, you know, they hate the rest of the country or whatever. They are just doing what they do because they think that the evidence about masks isn't particularly compelling and they, you know, should be allowed to have a little bit of freedom. Instead, it's this willingness to ascribe the worst possible motivation immediately to anybody who does something that you don't agree with. It's a really bad state of affairs.
Yeah,
Jeff, we're going to have to make this the sort of last couple of minutes if you don't mind, because I've got to run, unfortunately.
Yes, absolutely. I know we're bumping up.
So it's something you want to, you know, I know what you want to conclude with, but obviously up to you.
Yeah, I think just as a point of order for what you just said, I would challenge anyone who's listening to this to go find someone that you agree with, or I'm sorry, disagree with on one of these issues where it does seem to be black and white and you do think that they have the worst of intentions, and just reach out to them and be like, why do you think this way? You know, and ask them just openly, like, why do you think this way? And I guarantee you it is a product of the information they consume, and that they had learned something through probably a repetitive process. They're just getting hit from all sides that this is an objective truth and that these people are bad. And I think that if we did that across the board, it doesn't make you any less conservative or any less liberal or whatever it is, you know, back to the purity test, but it does make you more American, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think the last question I had was just your view on if this is the end of the 20th century model of objectivity. You know, is it already over?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. I think it is. I mean, I think that idea. So I think the idea that there was ever genuine objectivity was a bit of a myth, right? So again, you know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember the so-called, you know, what most unfortunately of our friends in the media think of as the sort of golden age of television news, which is kind of like the 70s and 80s. I can remember it in Britain, but I visited America a lot in the 1980s and lived here for a bit in the 1980s. So I remember that, you know, 6:30 evening news, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, they were sort of like the authoritative voice that told you, Dan Rather said at the end of his broadcast, that's part of our world tonight, right? That was it. That was like the statement. This was it. This is the best we could do in half an hour, but we've summarized your world, told you what you need to know. We've done it in an objective and fair and, you know, balanced way. And that was bullshit, frankly. I mean, we know it was bullshit. You just go back and look at those, and we now, and we've seen, you know, Peter Jennings is dead, sadly. Tom Brokaw sort of recently kind of disappeared. But Dan Rather is very much out there, you know, pumping out the most crazy, progressive conspiracy theories you could possibly hope for. So that golden age, we know, was no such thing. So the idea that there was kind of pure objectivity in media, and somehow, you know, with the arrival of Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, it all got, you know, terribly, terribly corrupted, is nonsense. The reason that Rush Limbaugh and Fox News came about is that people started to get wise to the fact that the people like Dan Rather were actually, you know, pushing a particular agenda night after night after night, and they got tired of it. So there was no golden age. That said, there is no question that we have come to a new phase where we do have, you know, and it's not so much even necessarily the institutions, although they have all changed. And, you know, the New York Times, as I said earlier, which kind of used to do, you know, for all its always had an agenda, used to do good quality, and it still does some good quality journalism. I'm not knocking on that front, but it's all in service of a particular agenda. Now, in the past, it wasn't all in service of that agenda. They would do some stuff that went against that agenda. So we got to that situation where the institutions like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and, you know, on the other side, if you like, Fox News, and out on the far extremes, the OANNs and the, you know, Breitbarts and Newsmax and, you know, MSNBC, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we don't, no question, we've got part, you know, hyper-partisanship in the media more than we've ever had before. But I think in a way, the more troubling thing is on the other end of the bargain, which is the consumer of news. And I think they've basically, you know, they now, you know, choose the information that suits their priors. They, you know, they don't anymore have to be confronted with any news, any information, any data, any facts that challenges their presuppositions and their prejudices in a lot of cases. And thanks to the miracle of digital media and technology, that's the situation we're in. And that is new. I mean, it's not completely new. And again, I do take the long view on this, and I constantly you know, read about and remind people about, you know, the early days of the Republic when you had these incredibly partisan newspapers saying, you know, the famous elections in the 1790s, in particular, you know, after 1796, and 1800 elections, or even more, you know, these are unbelievably partisan, vicious, nasty, falsehoods being said about each other, and you subscribe to one paper or the other, or you bought one paper or the other because you favored it. So we had similar things in the 1820s and the 1830s. Anyway, go on.
No, there's a, Andrew Jackson ran a newspaper out of his own White House.
Right,
and then
right.
I think Quincy Adams had his own paper that called Jackson's mother a whore during the election, and he wouldn't talk to him. So. Yeah.
No, exactly. So look, I don't think this is, unprecedented and, disaster. That said, America did end up having a civil war, in large part fueled by, narratives that people subscribe to that they became so passionate about that the other side was deemed to be completely evil. In one case, it was one side was evil in the Civil War. But look, I think I think we've been here before. We've seen these things in the past. I think the proliferation of information on social media probably, and digital media generally, makes it more of a challenge. I think we can kind of get it. I think we can get it back. I think that people will become, part of it, I think. And again, I do think one of the reasons the Wall Street Journal has done better at this than other organizations is that it's providing information that is actionable, right? We provide a lot of our readers and subscribers need the Wall Street Journal to invest or decide what they're going to spend their money on. I think in a way we need to find ways to make the media less about stroking people's feelings and prejudices and actually giving them information. It is interesting that there's been an explosion in hyper-local news, and because that's, whether you're a liberal, whether you're a progressive or a conservative, you do want to know if the store down the road is closed, is closing next week, or if, somebody was mugged on the street outside your house, So I think there are some trends there in media where people hungry for whether they are left or right, hungry for actual information. And I think maybe that could be the start of, again, to some extent, what we do at the Wall Street Journal, which is providing the bulk of our coverage is about providing, fact-based information about companies and markets and finance and all that kind of stuff. And I think maybe there's a hope there for us. And in a funny way, there's almost hope in the fact that mainstream media has become so valueless in terms of its actual practicality. And it has become increasingly about, appealing to someone's views, values, ideas, and prejudices. In a funny way, there might be something there that we should be that offers hope that it doesn't, the media is not making people's minds up anymore. It's just reinforcing people's prejudices. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer, but I'm not completely bleak and pessimistic. But right now, I think there is. I think this is we are in a very unhealthy environment. The media is absolutely contributing to that. A lot of the progressive media, with its insistence on the orthodoxy, is exacerbating this problem of conservatives and large parts of the country who feel alienated and disdained and despised, and who feel that their way of life is under threat, because in many ways it is under threat. If you can't, whether it's back to the baker who doesn't want to bake a cake for causes that he's not in favor of, as he sees them, that he's not in favor of, or the nuns with the contraception, their beliefs are being challenged, and they're being told by the media that their beliefs are sinful and wrong and must be extirpated. And I think that is where so much of the problem lies. Anyway, Jeff, got to go, but thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on. And there you have it, the interview with Gerard Baker. The one thing I want to point out is he is a great example of someone who obviously has studied the issues and takes on these issues that he has clearly thought a lot about. And there is a practice in today's society of clipping people and taking their words out of context and basically just tar and feathering people with those words, you know, without the context, because you as a media consumer, all of us, you know, we're getting so many things thrown at us a million miles a minute that it's hard to not take a step back and think about the context. And that's why I really love the podcast format, is because it naturally provides for context and nuance. If you listen to this whole interview, you understand where he's coming from. And I think that there are, you know, a few points that, you know, made me think of where you could clip him and you could probably get some cheap headline from it. But when you actually listen to it thoroughly, the entire thing of what he's saying, it's a very reasoned approach, right? I mean, he caveats everything with, you know, here's where I'm coming from. This is how I thought through it. And I just think that that is what we need more of in today's debate. And so that's why I really enjoyed the conversation that we had. I hope you enjoyed it too. I won't keep you much longer here. I just want to ask that if you subscribe, to also leave a 5-star review. Everyone's asking you to do that, but it does help. And I can tell you that I've been really excited to see the numbers so far. Probably not going to beat Joe Rogan tomorrow, but definitely doing better than I thought it would be right off the bat, which is pretty cool. But it also means that there's a lot of you who are listening right now who have not left a 5-star review yet. So go ahead and do that. Check out the Narrative Monopoly podcast on Twitter. Also find Gerard Baker on Twitter. And tune into his show on Fox Business. And that's all we have for you.